From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Governor Pritzker is set to deliver his annual State of the State and budget address today. They're actually combined this year because of the pandemic.
I certainly had no expectation when I became governor that we would spend all of this time battling an invisible enemy together. I had bolder plans for our state budget than what I'm going to present to you today.
The governor's banking much of his budget on proposals attempted by Democrats in the past by closing corporate loopholes, setting up a tried and true partisan standoff as Pritzker used his budget speech to take a swing at the far right.
Many on the far right have made their name in politics by touting cuts to unemployment programs and health insurance coverage. Amidst the tragedy of this pandemic, they have lobbied against the federal government providing relief to Illinoisans.
Instead of reforms that the state so desperately needs, he has put us on track just to continue to move money around, raise taxes on businesses, blue-collar workers, and the manufacturing sector here in Illinois. The governor continues to show just how out of touch he is.
1 month after Mike Madigan lost his bid to remain Speaker of the Illinois House, he has now closed the books on a 50-year career as a state lawmaker. He leaves under the cloud of the ComEd bribery investigation. Madigan has been implicated but not charged.
You know, all of those kinds of accusations and investigations unfortunately reflect poorly on public service in general.
Mike Madigan provided strong, sustained leadership for the Democratic Party.
And that is the current Illinois House Speaker Chris Welch talking about the end of an era, the first time in 50 years that Michael Madigan is no longer a member of the Illinois legislature. He resigned his seat this past week, just about a month since he was ousted as House Speaker. He remains the state Democratic Party chairman. Also, the governor has proposed a budget for the state, no across-the-board income tax, but few are cheering his spending plan. We'll discuss it all coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield, and our panel includes Charlie Wheeler. He's an emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, Hannah Meisel, who covers government and politics for NPR Illinois. And joining us today, Dan Petrella. He's a Chicago-based state government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. And Dan, thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Dan, let me start with the budget. I mentioned no income tax hike. The governor wanted voters to approve his graduated tax idea. That did not happen. What did you make of what the governor laid out this week?
You know, it's interesting. One of your clips there at the open had the line from the speech about how it was a less ambitious budget than he would have liked to present. And that's what really struck me in the speech and in the budget proposal. It's about a $41.6 billion general fund spending plan. No real proposals for ambitious new programs, but it's also lacking some of the painful cuts that the governor had been promising since the graduated income tax was defeated in November. They found some ways, as they always seem to when they put these plans together, to move money around from different funds, look at some other creative ways of generating new revenue to avoid mass layoffs or 5% across the board budget cuts like he asked his agency directors to come up with back in the fall.
Should we take from this spending plan that things are better for the state than what we might have been led to believe earlier?
It's hard to say. I think without these various what he would call closing loopholes on businesses, what his opponents would call tax increases on businesses, the plan is close to $1 billion out of balance. Those things all have to be approved separately from the spending plan. So, I think revenues have come in better than a lot of people expected, especially back early on in the pandemic when the whole economy was shutting down, not just in Illinois, but across the country. But there's still long-term big structural challenges that the state faces that this budget doesn't really address.
Yeah, Charlie, let me get your thoughts on the budget and what the governor had to say this week.
Well, I think it was pretty clear that this is not a budget that the governor is really excited about presenting. And as we said earlier, he's not able to do a lot of the things that he would like to do. One of the things that's not going to happen as things stand now is an increase in the money that's placed into the evidence-based funding formula for local school districts across the state. Under a reform enacted a couple years ago, the amount going to this formula fund was supposed to increase by $350 million each year. We didn't do it in the year that's going to end on June 30th, and the governor's proposal for the budget to start July 1st doesn't include it either. So that's something that they definitely would have liked to do. A lot of other things got held flat as well. Higher education, which is still suffering from, oh gosh, a couple decades of being underfunded compared to where it used to be in the past, is not going to get an increase, although there's, what, $28 million more going for the monetary assistance program, which is intended to help low-income families send their kids to college. So it is kind of a hold back what we'd like to do and try and make do with what we have.
Hannah, we heard Republicans not terribly excited and calling out the governor for this budget. Also, what about Democrats? Are they saying much at this point?
No, I feel like the most charitable characterization of Democrats' reaction is tepid response. A lot of them are saying, well, this is a good starting point. I think a lot of them are pretty upset, frankly, about the governor saying for the second year in a row, well, we can't afford to put this extra $350 million into that evidence-based school funding formula. That was, of course, if you remember, a big fight back in 2017, the biggest bipartisan thing I think we've seen in a long time. And that came about a month and a half after the budget impasse broke. But for districts, school districts that have been hurting for a while from the way that we used to fund schools, and to be told then that, you know, 3 years into this program that, oh, I'm sorry, we can't actually do it. We can't. That jeopardizes the 10-year plan to have parity and equity, which was the whole point of the law to begin with. Our other parts of the plan, the governor relies, he's asking the legislature to find $932 million in what he calls corporate tax loopholes. Well, you know, as we said before, one person's tax loophole is another person's tax incentive. And a lot of these things, they were passed on a bipartisan basis in the past. Not all of them. Some of them actually have to do with the big Trump tax cut bill back in end of 2017. And the governor wants the state to provide exemptions for those kind of things so the state can recapture some of that money. But some of these things were fairly popular and bipartisan. And I think a lot of members are going to be hard pressed to, you know, vote for something that, if they have a personal relationship to businesses in their district, business owners who are going to lobby, and, you know, you better believe that business groups are going to lobby really hard against these things. It's going to be a very, very difficult vote for these lawmakers.
When we hear corporate loopholes, Dan, people often think of, oh, this is, you know, huge business trying to get away with something, maybe. And in some cases, it might be that. At the same time, some of these so-called loopholes do affect smaller businesses, right?
Yes, they do. Although the governor's office is very careful to say that, you know, things like capping the deduction for net operating losses, while it could impact some smaller businesses, most of the businesses who are taking advantage of that are rather large, or most of the money that's being claimed is being claimed by a small share of the larger number of businesses in the state. But I think one thing politically too, to kind of to a point that Hannah was talking about, is several of these items were part of a bipartisan budget deal that Pritzker achieved in his first year in office. He got, you know, he came into office after years of acrimony under his Republican predecessor, and in his first year was able to get some Republican votes on his budget plan and his capital bill by agreeing to some of these these incentives, these tax credits and things. And now he is, from the Republicans' point of view, backtracking on that deal, doing away with these things. And some see that as retribution for the failure of the graduated tax, which Republicans campaigned very hard against.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, Charlie,
one of the things that the governor's office did, they put out a cheat sheet, and the things you were mentioning, Dan, according to them, is more than $900 million in these so-called loopholes, but the agreement that was made a year ago only accounts for about $200 million of it. And some of the other stuff is things that have been on the books for a while or things that the federal government did that, according to the governor's office, don't make really good sense and that benefit large corporations. And so there's maybe a way in the give-and-take negotiations to remove the language or to basically let some of the ones stand, like eliminating the franchise tax.
And you're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Dan Petrella. He's with the Chicago Tribune. And Dan, before we move on from the budget, we'll have a long time to talk about that over the next few months. What is the first thing that needs to happen with this? I mean, these lawmakers are not even in person at this point. That's hard to get negotiations started, I would think. Where do we go from here as far as the state budget? And I guess a lot of it is waiting on the federal government to take some action.
That's true, yeah. One big question mark and one probably very smart thing that the governor did was not count on any new aid from Washington in building this plan. Technically, under the Constitution, he's not allowed to do that, but he didn't even, you know, build in a scenario for that. What happens now is, you know, this proposal has been put in bill form and filed, and the various appropriation committees in the House and the Senate will start meeting and going through the proposal agency by agency, department by department, and trying to figure out how to cobble together their own plan, which may or may not reflect very much of what the governor laid out this week.
Well, and if I'm not mistaken, Dan and Hannah, didn't Greg Harris, the House Majority Leader, introduce, oh gosh, I think it was more than 100 bills the other day that carry the governor's budget in legal form?
Yeah, he posted a picture of, you know, a desk, actually a conference table, I would say, of, you know, piles and piles and piles of paper. If you zoom in, each pile was labeled like, you know, $ higher education, $ whatever. So, you know, just because he's filing them and carrying them, though, that, you know, he as a lead budgeteer doesn't mean that he is fully behind them.
Well, plenty of work to do there, but let's move on to another big announcement this week, and that came via press release from the former Illinois House Speaker, Michael Madigan, now just a state lawmaker, and not even that, after a couple of days ago. He decided to resign from his House seat. I think we knew that was coming, Hannah, but it still takes a little time to sink in that for the first time in really more than half a century, he's not going to be a member of the state legislature, but he is still the party chairman, and that is a key role, so he's not completely out of power.
That's right. He is still the party chairman, and he's still the 13th ward committeeman, which is a role he held even longer than his House seat. And that empowers him to basically choose his own successor. So he's not totally out of power, obviously. Not being House Speaker anymore, not being in the House anymore, that means that he is not going to be taking an active day-to-day role. But you know, he's still not going to be gone. I think this is a man who his whole identity of his whole adult life is Springfield and being a power broker in Springfield. But you're right. I mean, I think all of us were expecting that he would resign at some time. I don't think anyone would, like, even though he was actually assigned to 8 committees, I believe last week, I don't think anyone expected him to like go down to Springfield and actually just be merely Representative Madigan. But yeah, crazy. I mean, I don't think any of us are experiencing time in the normal way, you know, 11 plus months into this pandemic. And so It seems like just yesterday was January 13th when he handed over the speaker's gavel. Seems like, you know, maybe it was a day or two before that, that ComEd was implicated in federal court records as, you know, the company that orchestrated a bribery scheme for Madigan's benefit. And that was just last summer, but time has gone just in such weird ways. And so it has been quite the year, and it's just a lot to process.
Dan, that scandal in which Madigan was implicated, he's not been charged at this point. Speaker Chris Welch at the top of the show had some good things to say about Madigan, but I'm guessing some Democrats are probably glad that that he's finally out of the legislature.
Yeah, it was interesting that even some of the Democrats who have been more critical of him in recent months didn't really come out and celebrate his departure. Even Governor Pritzker, who had kind of tried to walk a fine line, not getting involved in the House Speaker election, but had previously joined Senator Dick Durbin and Senator Tammy Duckworth in calling for him to step down as party chair, put out a nice statement acknowledging the sacrifice that the Madigan family has made over the years to have Michael Madigan spending so much of his time on politics and government in Illinois. You know, and I think the big question for people is how much will he still be pulling the strings at the party level, and how long will he hang around in that job, or, you know, will it be a time that he'll step away from that eventually as well, and there will be real new leadership for the Democratic Party of Illinois.
Now, Charlie, you've followed Madigan's career from the early days all the way to now, till the end of his time in the General Assembly, at least. Your thoughts on Madigan? We've talked about it through the years, and we talked about it when he left the speaker's role. But you know, kind of sum up really what Madigan has meant to not only the Democratic Party but the state of Illinois and politics in Illinois.
Well, I may be in the minority here, but I think he's overall been a positive influence on the state, and certainly for the Democratic Party. If you think back to when Michael Madigan was first elected in 1969 to be a delegate to the Constitutional Convention, the Republican Party was dominant in Illinois outside the city of Chicago. And now it's been reversed. The Democrats control all the statewide offices. They have supermajorities in the General Assembly. And the Republicans, in my estimation, have really debased their brand in recent years, and so that people who were Republican leaders back in the day, like a Jim Thompson or Jim Egger, probably couldn't get through a Republican primary nowadays. But if you look at some of the things Madigan did for the Democratic Party, he's done a wonderful job. And even the people who were criticizing him, some of them would not have been in the General Assembly were it not for maps that Madigan drew, funding that he provided to their campaigns. But that's all part of the game. They're allowed to criticize. Well, and if you look at some of the changes that have occurred in Illinois, now, depending on what your attitude is, these are either good or bad. We've abolished the death penalty. We've allowed gay marriage. We've legalized recreational marijuana. Those are things that would not have occurred without, at the minimum, Madigan's acquiescence. And so the notion that he's been all bad, you know, what the Republicans have trotted out for the last couple of decades, I think is just malarkey.
Well, Charlie, also, you mentioned his acquiescence. He has not always been on the side of a lot of other Democrats, certainly more progressive Democrats on some of these issues, yet those issues have been allowed to move forward. He's even supported some of those as those have happened.
That's the point I was trying to make. He was a very accurate judge of the mood of his caucus and what would help get Democrats elected. So, and I've used this example in the past, 20-some years ago, the big issue was mega hog farms. So Mike Madigan, a guy from 64th and Keeler in the southwest side of Chicago, sponsors legislation, pushes it through dealing with mega hog farms. What does the southwest side of Chicago care about mega hog farms? Well, there were a couple of hot legislative races in western Illinois where hog farming is a big issue. And so that's the kind of thing, being sensitive to the needs of your members, that I think helped keep him where he was. So as I say, on balance, I think he's been good for the state. If you're a labor union person, if you believe in unions, he stood up to Bruce Rauner when Bruce Rauner tried to basically neuter unions in the state of Illinois. He stood up to Jim Thompson when Jim Thompson tried to, in my judgment and in Madigan's, excessively use the mandatory veto to rewrite legislation. So there's a number of instances like that where, as they say, if you agree with some of those notions, now, like if you think the death penalty is a good idea, then no, Madigan's bad because he helped abolish it. Or if you think gay marriage is an abomination, Madigan's bad because he didn't block it. But from my perspective, I think he's been very good for Illinois in balance.
Well, Dan, certainly he's been a strong leader, like him or not, through the years, and that includes getting some more controversial things done at times, including at times things like taxes or having to deal with some difficult budget situations. As Governor Pritzker goes forward here, do you expect that he's going to miss having someone like that who can shepherd through that type of legislation? Is that going to be that big of a deal going forward for the governor?
I think it's going to be a real test for Speaker Chris Welch to see if he has even, you know, a portion of the skill that Madigan had at trying to keep a very large and very diverse caucus kind of pulling in the same direction as much as possible, because that's what it's going to take. You know, Madigan was a master at structuring roll calls to make sure that he, you know, if they needed to take a tough vote on something like a tax increase, that he could afford to have members who might be vulnerable in the next election vote against it so that they would be safe and would, you know, keep his party in the majority. He had a lot of skill at that sort of thing and at, you know, trying to help various parts of his caucus advance things that mattered to them and that would help them get reelected. So I think it's going to be a big test, especially in a very difficult budget year, to see how adept the new speaker is at managing a caucus that maybe is now even, more fractured than ever, having come through the election where, there was the anti-Madigan faction and there was the Black Caucus that backed Madigan until it didn't. And then, you know, all these various people pulling in different directions. It'll be interesting to see how well Welch can get them all kind of on the same page.
And don't forget, we also have a new Senate president. I mean, Don Harmon was installed, in January of last year. Then, you know, not even 2 months later, COVID hit. So he didn't really have the chance to have a full session, first session as Senate president. And, you know, Don Harmon and Governor Pritzker's office do not see eye to eye. They have, some history there. And then we also have a new, the Senate Republicans are the smallest caucus. They wouldn't like to be told that they're, somewhat irrelevant, but, you know, there's strong personalities there and we have a new leader of that caucus. And I think they're going to want to be in on the budget making process to the extent that they can. And, you know, even if that just means making headlines and being upset about things, but it's a whole new ballgame. And I've definitely heard a lot of concern, especially among lobbyists who were used to the way that things used to work for so long, that there's not going to be enough people who know how to actually do this, and it could be messy.
Well, the times, they definitely are a-changing. Let me move on to our notes from the field, and Charlie, let's start with you.
Well, we've been talking about Michael Madigan, who was the longest-serving legislative leader in the nation's history, being Speaker of the House all but 2 years since 1983. Well, the longest-serving speaker before Madigan was a guy named David Shanahan, who was also a Southside Irishman, but he was a Republican. He served 12 years as speaker, not consecutively, but what I found interesting, and this is in the, what would you say, believe it or not, he was the Republican candidate for the 1936 election, and he died a couple weeks before the election. And so the Republicans had no living candidate on the ballot, and they started a writing campaign for the person that they wanted to succeed, Shanahan. Well, the Democrats also started a writing campaign for the county treasurer's 34-year-old private secretary. And 36, historians will note, was when FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, won a second term in a landslide. And the Democratic write-in got 8,539 votes. The Republican write-in only got 3,321. And the winning Republican in that district was a fellow named Richard J. Daley, who much later became Michael Madigan's role model and mentor.
All right, Hannah.
Well, we have, it's hard to believe, but November 2022 is just 20 months away. Petition passing season begins in September, and we've already got a couple of Republican candidates interested in going head-to-head with Governor Pritzker. Paul Schimpf, who was a one-term state senator from downstate Waterloo, announced his candidacy this week, and Darren Bailey, who's kind of the loudmouth state rep turned now state senator from Clay County. He obviously he's made a name for himself for the last year opposing all of the governor's COVID restrictions and filing lawsuits and, you know, getting on national news, you know, getting kicked out of the House back in May for refusing to wear a mask. And then, of course, coming back, I think the next day and having a mask on. Anyway, you know, they're going to be, it's going to be a very interesting field. You know, they're not the only ones. There's also a businessman from Chicago, but it's going to be very interesting to see how the GOP toes the line between, you know, what's going on nationally with their party and, you know, how they want to regain power for their party in 22, because it's also, like we've talked about, it'll be an opportunity for the party to make some waves depending on how the new map shakes out, because every single member of the General Assembly, including every single member of the Senate, is up for re-election next year.
All right. And Dan.
I want to take us back to the budget for a minute, something that's kind of been, I guess I would say, stuck in my craw since Wednesday. And it's on a slide that the governor's office put together on the Department of Public Health budget. And one of the things they are proposing is utilizing available federal funding, the department will begin the process of updating and modernizing their disease tracking and vaccination tracking systems, which was a little shocking to me to see 11, almost 12 months into this pandemic that the state is still working on modernizing those systems that are so crucial to our understanding of how COVID-19 is spreading and of how the vaccination distribution program is rolling out and who it's reaching.
All right. That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and the Chicago Tribune's Dan Petrella. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. And production assistance was provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.